I want to tell you a little bit this morning just about the lecture series that you're here to be part of. The reason you're here this morning for free is because there are two people by the names of Reverends Ray and Pat Harwick that in 1993 endowed the seminary with a fund that we now call the Harwick Lecture Fund. That fund is what supports this lecture and allows us to bring in wonderful and amazing speakers. The Harwicks are champions of biblical stewardship. And I had somebody ask me earlier this week, you know, did you guys really stop and think about what that lecture is about when you booked a youth ministry speaker? This is supposed to be about stewardship. What's that about? And it gave me the opportunity to talk a little bit. To talk a little bit about stewardship in a broader sense. Here at Lancaster Seminary, and certainly through the Center for Leadership Development, we realize that biblical stewardship is more than money. Biblical stewardship is really about everything we do as Christians. But we particularly think about who we are, what we have, and that includes not just money or funds, but that includes all of the people that are in our churches. And probably the most forgotten ones are the ones that we give lip service to and say, oh, they're the future of our church. Well, the future is here and now. The future isn't tomorrow. The future isn't next year or 10 years from now when they get old enough to have a voice. But the future is now. And those resources, those current leaders that sit among us, are who we're celebrating today. And that's why we felt it was very appropriate to offer this lecture as part of the Harwick Lecture Series. Now, I want to introduce to you our speaker for this lecture. When I contacted him, you know, when we book speakers, we always ask them, well, what nice things do you want us to say about you? Well, Mark sent back an email to me, and he said, well, you can look at my website and find my bio, he said, or just make something up. So here's what I have to tell you. I'd like to tell you that prior to his work in youth ministry, Mark was an astronaut chimp trainer for NASA. He says that was a very good foundation for working with church boards and with seminary institution leaders. Though I think there's some truth in that. I won't give up my day job, okay? Actually, I'd like to tell you that Mark has worked with young people and with the people who serve them for 20 years in congregational camp and conference settings. His research and ministry with young people has been groundbreaking in its exploration of spiritual direction, contemplation, and ancient spiritual practices as the basis of formation for young people. In 1996, he co-founded the Youth Ministry and Spirituality Project at San Francisco Theological Seminary, a grant-funded project that sought to test the integration of contemplative practice and awareness with congregational youth ministry programs. He directed that project from 1996 to 2006. When we were talking a little bit before the lecture today, Jackie and Mark were talking and I was listening. And Jackie said, it's such a privilege for us to have you here because actually our youth program has been founded based on one of the books that you've written, and I think was a contemplative youth ministry. There you go. Here it is. There's the book. There's the book. Right. Another one. They're popping up all over. So we truly are pleased and just honored to have Mark with us. Mark, who is a writer, a speaker, a husband, a father, a disco dancer, maybe we'll hear a little bit more about that at some point, I can tell you just from reading things on his website and from talking with him over breakfast this morning that he is generous and caring. He is deeply committed to the church, to all of the current leaders of the church, and that we are pleased and honored to give to you this morning as our 2011 Harwick Lecture Speaker, Mr. Mark Akinelli.
Well, good morning, everyone. I'm going to hook this on here. I had a red Bible this morning, and I set it down.
I know where it's at.
Or if somebody else has a Bible. That's it. So I want to, first of all, thank you for bringing me here. It's great to be in here in Lancaster. Am I saying that right? I've been working on that all morning. And I want to read a little passage here to sort of warm up our hearts and minds and give us a chance to pray a little, and then we'll see what God has to do today. So let me just read these words over you from Mark 12, verses 28 through 34. One of the scribes came near and heard them disputing with one another. And seeing that he answered them well, he asked him, "Which commandment is the first of all?" And Jesus answered, "The first is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And the second is this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There's no other commandment greater than these." Then the scribe said to him, "You are right, teacher. You have truly said that he is one, and besides him there is no other. And to love him with all the heart, with all the understanding, with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself, this is much more important than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices." When Jesus saw that he answered wisely, he said to him, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." And after that, no one dared to ask him any questions. Let's join together in prayer. And I want to invite you, as we sink down into our hearts, into that place where the Holy Spirit resides, I want you to see if you might notice what your prayer is this morning. What's your longing on this day? What's the question that stirs in you that you still want answered? And just for a moment as we begin, see if you might offer your own heart with all its mixed desires, your own mind with all its worry and anxiety, your own soul, the depths of your being, with its stillness and curiosity. In your own body, with its mixture of pleasure and pain. See if you might offer all of those to this mystery who we call God, saying, "Here I am, Lord. Here I am." God, we thank you for your presence here within and among us. We thank you for the restlessness that you bring within us to seek new ways of bringing life to the church, new ways of knowing your love in the world, new ways of caring for those generations younger than us. We ask that you would open our hearts and minds to what you have to bring us this day. And we pray all this in the name of Jesus. And all God's people said, amen. Henry Nouwen, a teacher from Yale, also taught at Harvard, Catholic priest, writer, spent the last years of his life in a L'Arche community outside of Toronto, a place called Daybreak. And L'Arche is a community of mentally, developmentally disabled folks who live in community together. And he was the chaplain, and he lived there the last 10 years of his life. And Nouwen tells this story. He said he was walking across the campus there, and as he was walking across, a young woman, one of the mentally disabled folks there, Jennifer, walked up to him, and Nouwen was on his way to a meeting, and she said, "Father, would you give me a blessing?" And Nouwen was used to this kind of thing, and he stopped, and he said, immediately, I started to make the sign of the cross on her forehead, and I said, "In the name of the Father and the Son," and she knocked my hand away and said, "Not like that. Do it right. Do it in the Mass tonight." And so Nouwen, not sure what she wanted, said, "Okay, we'll do it in the Mass tonight," and then he took off, went to his meeting. In that community, every night they have a closing worship service with the folks who live there as well as all the assistants and people who work there. And so they all gathered together for Mass at the end of that day. And Nouwen got up front and he said, "Before we do the Mass today," he said, "Jennifer has asked for a blessing." And he said, "So I'd like to ask Jennifer to come up." And Nouwen writes, he said, "I was trying to, put together in my head what it was that I should say or what kind of gesture or ritual she wanted so she would feel like this was a real blessing. And as I was kind of planning this up, she just walked down the aisle, walked straight up to me, and immediately put her head on my shoulder and reached down and grabbed my arms and wrapped them around her body and just laid there." And Nouwen said, "I just hugged her, and then I turned and I said into her ear, 'Jennifer, you are God's beloved. And with you, God is well pleased.'" And he said, "Then I just held her until suddenly she just released me and she turned and walked and went and sat down." And Nouwen writes, as soon as she sat down, a young man who worked there raised his hand. And I said, "Yeah, Steve." And Steve said, "Could I get one of those blessings?" And Nouwen said, "Yeah, come on up." So Steve came out of the aisle and walked up forward. And Nouwen said, "I wrapped my arms around him and laid his head on my shoulder. And I said, 'Steve, you are God's beloved. And with you, God is well pleased.'" And Nouwen said, "As soon as I released him, I noticed that people started standing up all over the pews and making their way to the aisle to get in line to get one of these blessings." Now, I have to be honest with you. If I was there in that room, sitting in the back, kind of at that service, and everybody stood up and everybody started making their way to the center, I would have been back there going, oh, crud. Are we really going to do this? All of us? One at a time, getting hugged and hearing that we're God's beloved. You know, because there's a part of me that says, okay, how many times do I have to hear that God loves me? I mean, I heard it all the way through Sunday school. I heard it through youth group. I hear it in church over and over. I've preached it over and over again. I've done it on flannel grams and worksheets and talk sermons and, you know, all these kinds of different ways and written it on posters and God loves you. God. Yeah, I get it. I know this. Do we really have to go and stand in line and get hugged and hear it one more time? And the reason I noticed that resistance in me is because there's a part of me that doesn't really believe it's true. There's a part of me that says, this is kind of this ritual we go through. It's this thing we say over and over. And there's a part of me that says, yes, I know God loves the good part of me. I know God loves the good works I'm doing. I know that God likes all the ways that I'm trying to be good, but not all of me. I'm not really God's beloved, not all that I am. And so a part of me feels like if I go through this ritual one more time, there's a falseness to it that I can't totally accept. The reason I tell this story is in ministry, the struggle, the heart of the struggle that we're engaged in. You see, ministry is an art, not a science. And the medium that we're working with is love. It's our struggle with God's love. Both that struggle within us, that struggle within our community, that struggle with the young people we serve, that struggle between our love for God, as well as our love for our own lives, our own self. And that struggle comes up all the time. And if we're not engaged with that struggle, both to know how to bear the beams of love, as William Blake has written, and to know how to carry that love in the world, if we're not engaged and aware and present to that ongoing struggle, we don't have anything to offer. Desmond Tutu, the Archbishop from South Africa, Nobel winner, went to Emory University, and he was asked to come. He was working on a book, this is a number of years ago, and he was given a house and a place to stay there at Emory for a year while he was working on this book and asked to do a series of lectures. They really wanted him to teach a class, but he said, I don't have time or the energy to teach a whole course, but they kept kind of, they were persistent, and eventually he said, well, okay, I'll teach a class in the spring, but I don't want to teach it in the regular university here at Emory. There's a theological school connected to Emory called Candler School of Theology, and he said, I want to teach it at Candler, and I want to put some requirements around it. So they said, great. He said, I want it to be for seniors only, and I only want those seniors who are going to go into the church and be ministers. I don't want to, it's not an academic class. I want ministry folks in their last year. And he said, I want to call the class God's Love. So my friend Michael Horinick was in that class. And he said, the first day we all sat down, we were all so excited. The Archbishop gets up there and he's kind of talking about what he wants to do with his class. And suddenly he starts kind of noticing that people are restless. And, you know, Michael said, you know, we're all used to being in school. We're all kind of looking around. And eventually the Archbishop goes, I notice people are a little bit restless. I notice people are looking around. Am I forgetting something? And one of the students raised their hand and says, yeah, is there a syllabus? I don't see a syllabus. You know, I'm just trying to figure out if there's books we're supposed to be reading or all that kind of stuff. And the Archbishop says, oh, no, there's no syllabus. I didn't put anything together. And one of the students says, well, are there going to be readings or tests or anything like that? And the Archbishop says, no, there's not going to be any tests and no papers. And in fact, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give all of you an A. Now, this does not sit well with anyone. I mean, this sounds like communism. You don't just give everyone an A, right? And the Archbishop says, well, you know, the thing is, you know, God has really low standards. Really low standards. So everybody gets an A. And he says, now here's what we're going to do in this course. He says, all we're going to do in this course is I'm going to tell you stories of when I encountered and experienced and knew God's love. And then I'm going to invite you to tell stories and to remember and recall moments where you encountered and experienced and knew God's love. He said, that's all we're going to do in this course. And he said, here's why. I know you've been in seminary for 4 years. I know you've studied your scriptures and hermeneutics. I know you've done exegesis. I know you've done your doctrine exams. I know you've studied theology. I know you've got preaching down and psychology and all these different things. He said, but if you leave this seminary and you don't know God's love in the marrow of your bones, you leave this school with nothing. You leave here with nothing. And so all we're going to do is tell stories and recall and remember those moments when we knew God's love. Now, Desmond Tutu, you know, I mean, he's got PhDs, he's got degrees, he studied theology, he studied church history, he knows the Bible, all these things are important, but he remembers what's at the center, what's essential. That if we're to resist the principalities and powers that surround us, if we're to have any warmth to offer those we serve, if we're to stay alive in the ministry and not burn out and become brittle and resentful, then we have to continually be in touch with that wellspring. We have to be in touch with what we know, not just what we believe, what we know, what we've experienced, what we've touched and seen with our own hands and our own eyes. That's the struggle that young people long for us to engage in. Otherwise, we're just talking. We're just adults talking, trying to tell them answers to questions they're not asking. Right? And so what I want to talk about this morning is this struggle to know love. I was at a conference a couple months ago, and Jeremy Myers, a youth director that I used to work with for about 10 years, and now he's a professor up at Augsburg University. So we were up late talking, and he was telling me about his son just got diagnosed with epilepsy, and he's 4 years old, and he's talking about how he's struggling with that. His dad has Alzheimer's, and they've brought him home to his house, so he's taking care of his dad. He's a professor, and he says, you know, the problem is I was a youth worker for 10 years. I can't just be a teacher. Like, I end up counseling these people, taking them out to dinner, giving them money when they're broke. I end up caring, you know, I feel like I'm a pastor more than I am a teacher. And he's kind of telling me his life story. We get later and later in the evening, and he says, you know, he said, I was at this youth group thing, observing it the other day as part of a research thing, and they were doing an exam, role play, where there was a lifeboat, and there's 10 people in the lifeboat, and they had to figure out who they're going to throw out and who they're going to keep. You know, it's a little ethics kind of thing, and they had a plumber and, you know, the mother and all these different kinds of things. And he said, I sat there kind of watching that thing, and he said, if I was on that boat, I would have said, I'm the first one you need to throw out. I don't have anything useful. I don't know how to make anything. I don't know how to build anything. I don't know how to watch the stars. I don't have any practical skills at all. And we both kind of laughed about it. The evening went on. The next morning, I had one of those things where I woke up at like 6 in the morning, you know, with just something wasn't right about that conversation. And that morning, I was supposed to preach at the conference, and Jeremy was there. And the sermon I'd prepared, I got rid of that thing, and I wrote out what showed up at 5 in the morning, which was this. I told him the story of this conversation, and I said, I need to just preach to Jeremy for a minute here. And I said, Jeremy, I know you don't know how to fix things. I know you don't know how to follow the stars and figure out how to track a boat. I know you think you are useless. But I said, what you do know, Jeremy, and what you've spent your life working on is you know how to love. You know how to love. That's your skill. That's your art. And it may make you the most valuable person in that survival boat, to know how to be compassionate towards others, to know how to listen to others, to know how to reveal the beauty of people to themselves till they see it, to know how to have compassion even when things are full of conflict. That's what we're working on here in the ministry. We're struggling with how to love. That's why we have courses here. That's why we have theological schools. That's why we have churches. We're learning how to practice love. And youth work is a school of love. Youth ministry is a school of love. And it's a a school for all of us, those engaged in it as ministers and those as students. And each of us are learning, how do we practice love? How do we become more and more transparent to this source, this mysterious source of love that we call God? So the first struggle that all of us are engaged in, that each of us seeks to practice, is the very thing we heard in the scripture this morning. The first struggle is the struggle to what I want to call to allow God, to give permission to God, permission to yourself, to allow God to love you. This is the first work of anyone called to ministry. And this is the first work that young people ask us to engage in, to allow God to love us. It's what was captured in that commandment, the most ignored commandment in the church, the commandment to practice the Sabbath. Right? It's a weird little commandment. And we understand, don't kill anybody. Don't lie. Don't steal. Okay, those kind of make practical sense for living in a community. It's a little bit weirder when it says, and I command you to take a day off every week. One day. And it's almost, when you hear that commandment, it's almost like it's connected to the other ones. Like if you don't take a day off, you might start killing people. You need a day off. And so God commands us, right, to take one day a week to nap. One day a week to sleep in. One day a week to eat good home-cooked food. One day a week to be with friends. One day a week to be with your family. One day a week to go outside and enjoy the created world. One day a week to read. One day a week to think, reflect on your life. One day a week to pray. One day a week to set aside your agenda. One day a week to step out of your role and as employee, or even as spouse, sister, mother. One day a week to remember the wide landscape of your being. Remember that? When you were a kid and the summer would show up and you'd lay in the grass and stare at the clouds and you could feel like there was no difference between the wide sky and the landscape around you and your own interior self. It was all this wide possibility. And God says you need one day a week to remember the wider landscape, that you are not what you do. You're more than that. And God says, the reason I'm making this a commandment is because if I don't make a commandment, you won't do it. You'll keep working. You'll stay busy. You'll begin to feel like the world is resting on your shoulders, that the world is what you're making of it. Right? You always have that, you ever have that thing in your job where you feel like, if I cannot possibly take any time off. If I take any time off, everything will fall apart, collapse. And then you get sick and you have to take time off and things keep running and you get angry. Right? I just had lunch with a woman in our town who's a doctor, and her husband is a doctor. He does retina surgery, transplants. And he has made it his mission to cure all preventable blindness, particularly in the developing world. If you know a book called Three Cups of Tea, okay, the author of that book has been following around this guy. His next book's going to be about him, about his mission to cure blindness. And he goes to Ethiopia and Indonesia and does all these operations. Well, I had lunch with his wife, and they've got two little kids. And I said, oh my gosh, it must be tough to tell your husband once in a while, like, hey, I'm burnt out. I need you to stay here. I need you to not go to Ethiopia to do these, because when you say that, you must feel so guilty, because it's like, go ahead and leave those people blind and disabled so I can have a little help at home and have a husband. And she said, I got over that years ago. When I need him to be home, I tell him, I need you to be home. And guess what? He always says, if I don't go, these people won't be saved and they'll stay blind and all that. And she says, it never happens. Every time he stays home, some other doctor fills in for him, somebody who's always wanted to do the trip, and he's replaceable. And what has happened to him, and thank God his wife keeps reminding him, is that the world doesn't rest on his shoulders. And until we learn to sort of sit back and allow ourselves to remember that life is a gift, that life is in God's hands, that we're just here a little while to help God in whatever little ways we can. That's what happens on the Sabbath. We release our life a little bit. We let go and we allow God to renew us and change us and grow us. And we allow our curiosity to rise up in us again. We allow gentleness and patience and compassion to come over us again. I mean, I wonder if one of the reasons that we're still engaged in these wars, and it seems like there's no resistance to it anymore, is we're all too busy. We're all too distracted. Our compassion is squelched within us. And so the first struggle we engage in is to take time to slow down and allow God to love us. That's our work in ministry. And it is a work. You ever try to take a day off just to pray and to rest and practice the Sabbath? You'll notice all the resistance you have to it. It's like the inertia of your life. You're like, each of us is like an 18-wheeler semi-truck going down the freeway, and you try and you can't pull over. You can't take any time off. And when you do, you can hear the squeal, the brakes. You know, it's like your life is just moving too fast. And it's killing our kids. Our kids who are being worked all the time, who are distracted, as, you know, T.S. Eliot said, you know, we live in a society where we're distracted from our distractions by our distractions. And that describes adolescence right now, right? Where it's the average young person now spends 26 hours a week in front of a screen, either, you know, texting screen, a computer screen, a television screen. That's what they thought initially. Then they went back and did the study. This was Kaiser Health Systems. And they found it's actually more like 33, 34 hours a week because a lot of times they're on two screens at once where you've got the TV on while the computer's going and you're texting your friend. So they split those things out. And there's no downtime anymore. There's no downtime. So one of the things we need to be practicing that, and one of the things we need to be doing with young people is giving them downtime. They need downtime, and it's exotic, and they will freak out and resist it. But I do things. I just was at a camp last summer up by Lake Tahoe, and I got done speaking to the kids, and that night we were going to have a worship service, and it was going to be inside the chapel there at this conference center that's right on the edge of Lake Tahoe. And this is summer, and the sun goes down late at night around 9 o'clock, and there's these gorgeous purple sunsets that come out over the Sierras that you can see, and it reflects, especially when the lake's still, just reflects onto the lake, and it's just stunning. And worship was scheduled right around sunset. And I'm having dinner with the kids before then. There's about 150 kids, and I'm sitting amongst a group of them. And I said, have you guys seen this? Been watching the sunsets out here? I said, they're spectacular. And you've seen how they go, it goes behind these mountains and you see these shadows over the lake. And these kids are going, no. And one kid says, I've never seen a sunset. I said, you've never seen a sunset? No, you know, kind of. I've never like sat and watched a sunset. And I just thought, that's what we're doing tonight. So I went to the people who were organizing. I said, instead of the worship service inside the chapel, can I do this thing with the kids? They said, okay. So I took the kids together. We got down on the side of the lake. And I said, here's what we're doing for worship tonight. Is I want everybody to go sit by yourself along the lake, and I want you to say, and some of these were Christian kids, some of them were non-Christian kids, so I want you to say, God, I want to be with you right now. Or Jesus, I want to sit here with you right now. Or God, if you exist, I would like to notice you in this time right now. And then I want you to just be by yourself and just notice what it's like as the sun goes down to be with God and watch the day come to a close. See what prayers come up, see what conversation comes up. And we're going to sit in silence. And then when the sun drops, then we're all going to come back together and talk about it. Of course, you know what the first question was by the kids. How long is this going to last? How long is a sunset? It's going to be about 30, 40 minutes. Can we bring our phones? No. We're going to put all the gadgets, phones, iPods, everything here by yourself. And of course, everybody was really nervous about this. Like, what's it going to be like to sit without these gadgets, without talking to my friends for 40 minutes, watching the sun go down? And a lot of kids were dreading it, like this was going to be the longest 40 minutes of their lives. And so we spaced them out. Everybody sat on the edge of the thing. The sun goes down. Now, I've done things like this 4 or 5 times. And every time this happens, we sit there, and after a while, a few kids will start to weep. And the first time that ever happened, I did this on the Oregon coast, I thought there's problems among the group, there's some kind of fighting going on, there's a trouble in the family, and I would go and interrupt the kids, even though I said no one talks to each other. I'd say, what's going on? I see you're teary. And the response, of course, was, it's just so beautiful. It's so beautiful. Or, I've never seen the sun go down before. Or, I'm so exhausted and sad, and they haven't got a chance to feel it. And so we sit there, and I let them sit and watch that sun drift down and watch the shadows and the lavender colors spread across the sky. And then we get together, and then I ask them, what's God like? We asked God to be with us during time. What's God like? And kids say things like, I get it why we call it worship services. It's just magnificent to watch what's happening. You see, we're living in an age where kids are denatured. They no longer live in the rhythms of nature anymore. They no longer are susceptible to wonder the way they used to be. They're completely, the marketplace has found a way, the media culture, to sort of monopolize every moment. And so as we learn to slow down and practice the Sabbath and allow God to come over us, allow God to love us, we also begin to learn how to do that with kids and allow them this kind of downtime. The second struggle we're engaged in is this. Not only is there a struggle to allow ourselves to be loved by God, the second struggle is the struggle to be compassionately attentive to our own souls. Is to develop a sense of compassion towards your own journey. Jesus says we're to love God with all our heart, with all our mind, with all our strength, with all our soul. And we do that by entering into that relationship, by laying down in grass, by sitting at the edge of a lake, by praying, by allowing God, by receiving God's love. But the second move, Jesus says, is to love others as we love ourselves. And the more I work in ministry, and the more I sit, I go to conferences where I serve as a spiritual director, the more I listen to the souls of ministers, there is this inner voice of judgment, this inner voice of self-hatred. And it's so strange because I bet you, for those of you who are in ministry, I could probably bring any kind of human being up here. And you would struggle to find some way to have empathy for that person, to be compassionate towards that person. If I was at this conference where I was being spiritual director, if I brought up to you the young men who are struggling with pornography, you would find some way to be compassionate about that as you worked with them. If I brought you up the young woman who I met who had cut her arms up, you would find some way to be compassionate towards her, right? But when we engage in those behaviors, we have nothing but judgment and hatred and shame towards ourselves. And the thing I'm learning is that when we don't allow our compassion for others, that most of us are good at, our caring for others, being attentive to others, we don't allow that to spread in all directions towards ourselves as well, it becomes restricted and limited. That the people who remind us of ourselves, we have difficulty caring for. And so Jesus shows us that there's this really unique connection that we have to love others as we love ourselves. That our capacity to love, it drops and expands as we learn how to love ourselves as much as anyone else. And that means paying attention to your souls and trusting what comes up in you. I want to say a little bit more about that. What I'm beginning to learn more and more is that every energy that comes up in us, there's something right about it. So when I'm working with the young woman who is cutting her own arms, as I listen to, and the thing that's painful about it is she's in the ministry, and so she feels absolute shame about this. She knows this is wrong, and I shouldn't be doing this. And so it's sort of this double hatred and shame, right? But as we listen to her, as both of us sit and try to listen to where this is coming from, and we find the root of it, which is a childhood filled with abuse, we realize there's something right about this. There's a pain in there that's trying to be heard. There's a suffering that's trying to make itself known. And once we're able to see that root of that energy, that desire, then we can listen to it and find a way of expressing it and listening to it that's less destructive. And we can remove the shame over it, and we can feel a sense of compassion over it. And so more and more, I'm learning that every energy that comes up on us, whether it's rage or depression or anger or lust, there's something at the root of it that's right. It's not a surprise to me that as I listen to these young men who are, you know, struggling with pornography addiction, that at the root of that behavior, there's this desire to be connected again to someone. And once we listen to that, and once these men are able to have compassion for that right desire, a good desire, then we can find another way, another form of behavior that's less destructive to them and to their families, right? And so what all of us are engaged in as ministers is to learn, this is the hard work of ministry, to be compassionate towards those places in you that are full of shame, that are in the darkness, that are full of hurt. And we need to learn to offer the same kind of compassion to those places in us that we struggle to offer to others. Let me give you an image of that kind of breakthrough. So we had a neighbor come over to our house, and our boys used to play together in a field that was between the houses at the seminary. And he came by, and he asked my wife, he said, this is going to be a strange request. We don't know each other that well, but our kids play together. We see each other at a park. And he said, I'm in a group for children, grown children of alcoholics. He said, I've been going to this group for a while. And we have this ritual where we tell our life story. And I'm going to be telling my life story. And I'm supposed to have people who know me in different parts of my life to come and hear it. So I have people from work and people from my family. And I'd like to have someone from the neighborhood. And you're the only one I kind of know. Would you be willing to come and hear my story? And so my wife said, yeah, I'll come and hear the story. And she did. And a lot of his wounds and pain were around a graduation, an incident that took place at a graduation ceremony. And when he finished, my wife said, you know, we were having coffee and stuff afterwards. And she said, I sat next to this woman and she told me this story. She said, all of my suffering, she said, has taken place at graduations. She said, when I was a little girl, she said, both of my parents were alcoholics. We lived in a nice suburb. You wouldn't have known it from the outside. We had a car. We had a nice house, I mean, a beautiful car. My father had a good job. But most of my time in that home was spent with my parents in an alcoholic stupor. They just would drink all night long. Sometimes they wouldn't get up for work. Sometimes they'd drink over the weekend. And you look at photographs of me, and you can tell that I was neglected, that no one was paying attention to me. My hygiene was poor. My hair was not combed. All these little kid pictures, my clothes are too short. And she said, I basically grew up really within myself. I didn't have friends. I didn't really know other people. I was just sort of this solitary kid. And she said, but about sixth, seventh grade, I discovered something about myself. I didn't really know anybody, but I discovered that I was smart, that I knew what the teachers were talking about, that I liked reading the books. And this light bulb went off inside of me, and I just started pouring myself into the schoolwork. She goes, I went through high school. Again, I wasn't in any clubs. I didn't know any other kids. But I poured myself into school. And when graduation came at high school, I was so excited because they had this thing they did at the high school where those graduates who had a high GPA got to wear, in the ceremony, they got to wear a gold cord over their robe. And I was so proud when they said this because I thought the rest of my classmates and the rest of my community are going to finally see that I'm intelligent, that I'm smart, that I have some worth. And so she said, I went to that ceremony. I sat up there. I had my gold cord on. And then the principal, she said, made this terrible announcement. He said, we have a lot of graduates. They're inside a gymnasium. And he said, it's a long ceremony. So I want to ask people to refrain from applauding when a student is called to get their diploma so we can get through this quickly. And after everybody gets their diploma, then we'll all stand and cheer them all as one. She said, the problem with this announcement was this. She said, nobody listened and obeyed this announcement. Well, what would happen is a name would be called for some student, and a group of family members would stand up and cheer anyways. And sometimes even students would stand up as well and cheer. And no matter how many times the principal said, we're going to ask everybody please to refrain from applause, they still did it. And so that every kid had some kind of noise, some kind of applause. And she said, I started to get this sick feeling because I knew when my name was called, it would remain silent. She said, so I started to kind of look out and just pray that my parents had shown up. She said, my mother didn't come. I saw my dad standing against the back wall. He looked completely bombed. He was with a drinking buddy of his. They're standing against the back wall. And she goes, I just stared at them. Please, please, please make some noise. Do something when my name's called. She said, instead, when my name was called, I stood up and I walked across that stage in silence. And she said, I just felt so ashamed. When the ceremony was over, she said, I threw my robe, I threw the diploma away, and I walked home just full of tears. It was like this public humiliation. I went on to college. I got my degree. I went on to law school. She skipped her college graduation. She said, I went on to law school. I got my degree. Still very isolated. Still didn't know people. Got my law school degree. Showed up to the law school graduation. And suddenly this memory came back to me of what had happened to me in high school. And I panicked. And I found a group of teenagers. And I went to them and said, hey, when my name's called, would you guys cheer for me? And I paid them what money I had in my wallet for them to cheer for me. And you can imagine this woman who's getting a law degree paying strangers to cheer for her. And so she said, I sat in that ceremony and I couldn't believe it. The dean made the very same announcement that they had made when I was in high school. Please refrain from applause. And she said, in that ceremony, my name was called. I looked to the teenagers. They weren't paying attention. And for the second time in my life, I walked across a stage publicly in silence. And she said, that night, I became an alcoholic. It just all crashed in. Everything collapsed within me. And she said, I lost 10 years. I lived in women's shelters. I lived on the streets. I lived with different men. And I just became an alcoholic stupor. I finally got into AA. I pulled myself out. I met this nice man. We got married. And she said, 3 or 4 months ago, I had my very first birthday party. Said, I came home from work. I'd never had a birthday party in my whole life. She said, I walked inside the house, and Bill, her husband, she said, had all neighbors from the apartment complex, people from AA, people at my new job. She's working as a legal secretary. And all these people jumped up and yelled surprise, and it was like a kid's party. He had little streamers. He had little kid's party hats. He had pin the tail on the donkey. He had little toys and gifts, and it was a riot. We played musical chairs. We played all these kinds of games, all the things I never got as a kid. And then as the party kind of came to a close, he had everybody sit around the television, and he puts on this DVD. And her husband is a sound engineer and works with a video company, and they put on this DVD, and it's like a retrospective of my life. It's like photographs with music, and there's interviews from people who know me talking about my good qualities, and I'm watching all this stuff. And then we come to the end of the movie, and all of a sudden, up on the screen comes the law school graduation. He had contacted the school and got a copy of the videotape of the graduation ceremony. And she goes, up onto the screen comes this law school graduation, and it's right at the moment where the dean announces my name, and I'm walking across the stage, and I just freeze, and I watch myself stand, watch this young woman who's trying so hard to prove her worth walk across this stage. And except that this time, she said, my husband had recorded himself in an auditorium over 100 times. He looped it over and over and over again so that this time when I walked across that stage, instead of silence, there's my husband and over 100 voices going, woohoo, way to go, fantastic, that's great. So it sounds this whole kind of audience, and all of a sudden I'm walking across and there's all this cheering, and she said, I'm watching this, and she says, it's one of these out-of-body experiences. Before I even knew what I was doing, I stood up and yelled, turn that off, that's not how it happened, turn it off. And she said, everyone just froze. My husband went up and turned the television off. It got awkward. And I just ran into the bedroom and I just fell apart. And she said, my husband came in and said, I'm so sorry. I can't believe you showed that. That was the lowest point of my life. And you show this at a party? Like it's some kind of joke? And she said, I just screamed at him. I fell on the bed and all of the shame And all of the pain of my life just poured over me. And I just laid on that bed and wept and wept and wept. Bill asked all the friends to leave. And then she said, about 2-3 in the morning, when I finally kind of calmed, I walked back out into that living room. He said, my husband wasn't sleeping. He heard me and he came out. We didn't say anything. I just walked up and she said, I put that DVD back into the player. And I sat down and I forwarded that thing all the way up to where that law school graduation was. And I played it. And this time, I sat and I watched myself working so hard to hide the pain, to prove I had worth. And this time, she said, I listened and I heard my husband in over 100 voices calling my name, telling me I have value, seeing what was beautiful in me and shouting it and clapping out loud. She said, my husband started to apologize again and I just turned to him and said, you know what? I like it. I like it. Let's leave it how it is. That's the journey that each of us is engaged in to struggle with. That's part of our gift to the young people and the members of our churches that we serve, is that we struggle to not only get to know who God is and allow God's grace and love to move and breathe in us, but we allow it to heal, to teach us how to be compassionate towards those parts of ourselves that are still longing to be heard, the wounded child within us. And as we learn to have compassion for those parts of ourselves, we learn how to carry a deeper sense of grace and generosity towards those we serve. It's all of one piece that we're working on. And the third struggle is this. Not only do we struggle to allow God to love us and to learn how to love ourselves with a sense of compassion, but we also learn how to be attentive to others. The third struggle is, you see, attentiveness is the first act of love. The first act of love is to be attentive. And so part of our struggle in loving our neighbor as we love ourselves is to learn how to pay attention to those around us. And all of this, let me give you an example of the sort of what we're working with. I got to, as Kathy said, work in something called the Youth Ministry and Spirituality Project. And what we were trying to do was integrate contemplative practice and contemplative awareness in youth ministry. I know some people said that, you know, that's impossible to begin to use silence and solitude and that kind of stuff in a room full of junior high kids. And what we discovered was that there was really a spirit. This is what I, and this is a little simplistic, but that the principalities and powers we were up against that come to a head in a youth room and in churches is that most of society is rooted and grounded in a spirit of anxiety. And we were trying to figure out how do we resource youth ministries, resource youth workers into a spirit of love so that we're rooted and grounded in love in everything we do with our kids. And this is a little simple tool we started to use to try to understand how this works in us. You see, when we're in a spirit of anxiety, anxiety is always interested in control. And this is the thing about youth ministries is youth ministries are ministries of anxiety. In fact, you don't even get a youth ministry started until there's a group of adults who have reached a point of anxiousness. You know, once you have a group of adults who are anxious about church membership is dying, we need families, or anxious about parents who are anxious that, you know, our kids are getting involved in drugs and they're getting involved with the bad kids, so we need a youth. Once you get enough adults freaked out, that's when a youth ministry gets started, right? You have to have a critical mass of freaked out adults and then they start a youth group, and they hire you to take care of the anxiety. And the anxiousness is usually about the church is dying, we need young families, or kids are getting in trouble, or parents are saying our kids aren't nice, they don't listen to us. We need a youth director to tell them the Ten Commandments about being nice, right? That's kind of what happens. I'm going to church next weekend, I was telling Kathy, up in Detroit, and I was talking to the parents on a conference call, and basically what they want is their kids to be, they want a youth group so that the kids will be nice and safe. You know, and of course teenagers have no interest in either of those things. So there's a spirit of anxiety in our churches, especially right now when most mainline churches are dying. And everybody's anxious and they want to get something going. So when we're anxious, we want someone to get control of the situation, right? When we're anxious, we want results. When we're anxious, we want an expert. We want a professional. We want someone who knows what they're doing. When we're anxious, we want conformity. We want ducks in a row. We want a system. We want some manual that tells us what to do, and we know that it's worked at that church, and now we're going to replicate it here and then replicate it here until the whole denomination rises as one. You know, we want some kind of system. When we're anxious, we want answers. When we're anxious, we focus on problems. What's not happening? When we're anxious, we want things done faster. When we're anxious, our identity is, I am what I do. So what do anxious parents ask, anxious adults ask kids all the time? What are you going to do? What are you going to do when you get out of high school? When you're anxious, God becomes taskmaster or the magical genie. Someone we bring wishes to. Or someone who's constantly driving us to do more. When we're rooted and grounded in a spirit of love, there's a different way of being. Instead of control, love seeks contemplation. Being present to what is. Or a long, loving look at the real. Walter Burkhardt's definition. When we're rooted and grounded in love, instead of results, love is far more interested in relationships. Instead of professionals, love is far more interested in process, what we're going to do together. Instead of conformity, love is far more interested in creativity. Instead of answers, love seeks questions. Instead of problems, love is far more interested in people or presence. Instead of faster, love wants to slow things down. Instead of I am what I do, love calls us beloved. Instead of a driving taskmaster, God becomes the compassionate friend. And this is just a little thing. We began to come up with all kinds of lists of trying to describe these two different ways of being. And the struggle in ministry is, how are you going to stay rooted and grounded in love? And what young people are thrown into is they're being formed in a culture that only... You see, anxiety means to choke, the etymology of the word. And when we're anxious, we're in the shallows. We're only living from sort of the throat up, right, when you're anxious. And most young people believe this is the world. That's all there is. Right? What are you going to do? What's your answer? How are you going to fit in? That kind of a thing. How are you going to get things done faster? Your identity is based on what you do. Or as my friend Michael Herenik says, the trinity of false identity. I am what I do, I am how much I do, and I am how well I do it. That's how I know my own worth. Or what Marcus Borg calls the three A's, that my self-worth is based on achievement, affluence, and there's one more, appearance, right? Those are the shallows. And our work as ministers is to figure out how we're going to live into the depths. One of that way is slowing down. The other way is starting to pay attention to our own soul, our own life with God. And the third way is to begin to pay attention to our relationships. Any questions or comments on this? It's a different way of being we're struggling with. And it's hard work. I led a retreat called Sabbath for 9 years, and we took youth workers and pastors, and we would do a whole week. We used to call it a retreat about nothing, because we would come in, we didn't do any mixers, we didn't have name tags, you could be anonymous if you wanted to be, and we would come in, and every morning you had to stay in silence from when you woke up until noon. We would do one spiritual practice in the morning and one in the afternoon, and then you met with a spiritual director at night who you would just talk about your day with, what you noticed, what God was doing. And people would come and say, oh, I heard about this retreat. I couldn't wait to get here. Gosh, I need a break from all my life. I can't wait to be on this retreat and, you know, just be get some downtime. But every year, the first 6 years I ran it, we would have people leave. People would disappear on the third or fourth day. And usually what happens, a roommate would come up to me and say, you know, my roommate's gone. I just noticed, you know, they weren't at chapel this morning. They weren't in the practice. Their bags are packed. They're gone. Have they said anything to you? And I'd say, no, you know, they didn't ask for a refund. They didn't tell us why they left, you know, and this would happen every year. And sometimes I would say, just because I like to create problems for people, I would say, you know, I think that what happened is a number of people left last night and you were left behind. You have a couple more days to change your ways. And that's it. But it took me a while to figure out why people were leaving. And of course, the reason they were leaving is it's hard work to sit still. It's hard work to move out of this way of being into a deeper way. That what starts to show up when you slow down is all the repressed anger or depression or loneliness or doubt. And so in ministry, we're the ones willing to sort of, like Jesus, you know, it says Jesus descended into hell. We have to descend as well into those hard places. And discover what really is true, what really is life-giving. And then when we come out of those as resurrection people, we have something to offer those that we serve. But it's a different way of being that we're seeking to embody. That's what all of this is about. And if you're doing anything in seminary or school or in your ministry that's not helping you to stay in this way of being, stop doing it. Right? The Christian faith is good news. What that means is when you hear it, it sounds good. There's something attractive about it. And anything that continues to make us hyperactive, distracted, less alive, more cramped, more pressed in, more anxious, more full of fear, less trust, is something we need to let go of. That's the life-giving guides, spiritual guides that young people are looking for.